Think about the last time you backed up your computer hard drive. You know, you check that little progress bar, you watch the file icon zip across the screen, and you breathe this massive sigh of relief when it finally hits 100%.
Oh yeah, that instant feeling of safety.
Right. Because if your laptop crashes tomorrow, your photos, your tax returns, your creative projects, they're safe. But I want you to imagine, just for a second, trying to back up the soul of an entire community.
That is a completely different scale.
Exactly. We are not just talking about saving dates and facts to some cloud server. We are talking about digitizing 900 years of identity, humor, shared trauma, and a completely unique way of looking at the world. And now imagine the tool you're using to perform this monumental backup artificial intelligence might actually be rewriting your history while claiming to save it.
Which is terrifying.
It begs a pretty huge question, you know?
Yeah.
If an AI summarizes your history, does it actually understand who you are?
It's a profound existential dilemma, really. And the thing is, it's happening right now. We are witnessing this massive collision between medieval history and the absolute bleeding edge of generative AI.
Okay, let's unpack this, because our mission for today's deep dive is incredibly specific, but the implications, I mean, they affect every single one of us. We are exploring how to save a 900-year-old culture from being distorted or just completely paved over by algorithms.
Yeah, and our guide for this journey is this fascinating project called Transylvanian Saxons: A Portrait.
Right, spearheaded by the philosopher and political scientist Dr. Johann Lauer. And as I was reading through Lauer's work, we're looking at this one specific community, but it really felt like the ultimate test case for humanity in the digital age.
Absolutely. Because what's fascinating here is that Dr. Lauer, he isn't just trying to preserve dusty history in a museum display case, he's building a blueprint.
A blueprint for survival.
Exactly. He is demonstrating how any displaced group, any minority culture really, can actively use modern technology to protect what he calls their invisible baggage, so their cultural heritage, to protect that from the digital noise and the inevitable hallucinations of modern AI.
So to really grasp why this culture needs such high-tech saving in the digital world today, we have to look back at how they managed to survive the physical world for the last 9 centuries. Because when you look at their history, they built some of the most intense, successful defenses imaginable.
They absolutely had to. I mean, if we go all the way back to the 12th century, the Hungarian king invited these German settlers, primarily from the Rhine-Moselle region, to settle in Transylvania.
Which sits in present-day Romania, right?
Yes, exactly. And the king, he didn't do this out of charity. He needed a buffer zone. He needed a fiercely loyal population to guard the eastern borders of his kingdom against
That
invasions.
is a dangerous job.
Very dangerous. So, in exchange for doing this, in 1224, King Andrew II issued the Golden Charter, or the Adrianum. And this was a monumental piece of medieval legislation because it granted these settlers an unparalleled level of autonomy on royal land. The charter explicitly encouraged them to be united as one people.
And they needed that unity because the neighborhood they moved into was, to put it mildly, volatile.
Oh, incredibly volatile.
I mean, they faced massive Mongol invasions in the 13th century, which just decimated the population, and then centuries of relentless Ottoman attacks. So their response was to build walls. Like, literally, they transformed their everyday places of worship into massive fortresses.
Yeah, by the 16th century, they had totally perfected this fortified church construction. Even today, there are about 190 of these incredible architectural marvels still dotting the Transylvanian landscape.
Which is just wild to think about, 190 of them.
It is. But those physical walls, you know, they kept the swords and arrows out. A stone wall can only protect your physical body. To protect a culture for 900 years, you need something far more intricate.
And this is what Lauer describes as spiritual walls, right?
Exactly. So in 1486, they founded the Saxon National University. Now, despite the name, it wasn't a school.
Okay, I was definitely picturing a college campus.
Right. No, it was a political and administrative body that functioned almost like a modern shield of citizenship. It protected their legal autonomy from outside nobles. Then, during the Reformation, the entire community universally adopted the Evangelical Church of the Augsburg Confession, which created this immense religious solidarity.
And they didn't stop there. I mean, they maintained their own highly distinct Transylvanian Saxon dialect, which bonded them linguistically. They were pioneers in education, introducing compulsory schooling for both boys and girls as early as 1722.
Which was practically unheard of at the time.
Totally. And my favorite mechanism, they created these incredibly strict neighborhood associations called brotherhoods and sisterhoods, When you came of age, you joined. If your neighbor's roof caved in, the Brotherhood fixed it.
Yeah, and if there was a social dispute, the Sisterhood mediated it. It was this hyper-localized support system.
I'm just marveling at the sheer engineering of this society. It feels like an early physical social network. They constructed a literal fortified castle that surrounded a person from cradle to grave. It dictated your language, your religion, your neighborhood duties. But I have to push back a little on the romanticism of this.
Go for it.
Doesn't a castle of that magnitude also trap you inside? Like, if you build physical and spiritual walls that high and make leaving impossible, aren't you just breeding extreme isolationism?
See, that is a completely natural assumption when we hear the word fortress. We imagine closed gates and, like, hostility to outsiders. But Lauer brings in a concept from the writer Hans Bergel called defensive tolerance.
Defensive tolerance.
Yeah. The walls weren't built out of xenophobia. They were pragmatic tools for survival in a highly contested multi-ethnic region. The Saxons realized that picking fights or trying to conquer their neighbors would literally just lead to their own destruction.
That makes sense.
So they practiced defensive tolerance. They explicitly avoided religious wars. As early as 1557, they officially committed to religious tolerance in their territories. The massive walls were there to protect their autonomy, to ensure they could be left alone to govern themselves, not to launch attacks on others.
And that strategy worked brilliantly for centuries. They survived the Mongols, they outlasted the Ottomans, they navigated the shifting borders of empires, which to me makes the modern reality so jarring.
It is a stark contrast, yes.
Because if that fortified castle was so incredibly effective, why are the Transylvanian Saxons now scattered across the globe? I mean, I want you listening right now to picture your hometown. Imagine if tomorrow 90% of your neighbors were just gone.
It's hard to even fathom.
Because today, less than 10% of the Transylvanian Saxons actually remain in Transylvania.
Yeah, the transition from centuries of steadfast stability to the violent disruptions of the 19th and 20th centuries was devastating. The rise of the modern nation state and aggressive nationalism fundamentally fractured their existence. Yeah. That defensive tolerance that protected them in medieval times, it was completely useless against modern demographic warfare and state-sponsored ethnic cleansing.
They were brutally caught in the crossfire of national chauvinism. During World War II, treaties between the Third Reich, Hungary, and Romania mandated that German men from these regions be conscripted into the German military.
Which is a crucial point. Transylvania was never part of Germany.
Right. These people had been living in Romania for centuries. But because they spoke German and shared that ethnic origin, they were pulled into a war that ultimately destroyed their homeland.
And the backlash following the war was horrific. They became victims of something called kin liability.
Kin liability.
Essentially, the Soviet Union and its allies decided to punish ethnic Germans collectively for the atrocities of Nazi Germany, regardless of where those individuals actually lived or what they had done.
Wow.
So on January 6, 1945, 30,336 Transylvanian Saxons were talking men between 17 and 45, and women between 18 and 35 were rounded up and deported to Soviet labor camps.
That is just heartbreaking.
Over 3,000 of them died in those camps from starvation, freezing temperatures, and brutal labor conditions.
And the tragedy compounds because even after the war, they couldn't just go back to normal. Decades of harsh communism followed under the Romanian regime. And then something almost unbelievable happened. The Ceausescu regime practically sold its own citizens.
Yes. West Germany began paying the Romanian government cold, hard cash to allow ethnic Germans to emigrate.
And people fled. I mean, this led to a massive generational exodus. Today, this historic community is primarily living in Germany, Canada, the USA, Austria, and Switzerland. Their shared geographic space was essentially wiped out.
And that total loss of geography brings us to a really beautiful, highly poignant adaptation of their identity.
The coat of arms.
Yes. The traditional Transylvanian Saxon coat of arms features seven physical castles, which originally represented their seven administrative seats back in Transylvania. Today, Dr. Lauer notes that those seven castles have taken on a completely new meaning.
I love this part.
Six of the castles now represent the six main countries they inhabit today, and the seventh castle represents the rest of the world.
That visual adaptation is just stunning. They literally remapped their identity onto a global scale.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the tough question.
Okay.
If you lose the physical land and you aren't speaking that unique Roysen dialect at the grocery store every day and your local brotherhood isn't there to fix your roof, aren't you just a nostalgia fan club?
See, this raises an important question about what actually constitutes a culture. Dr. Lauer addresses this through his concept of the Open Club. The community realized that to survive, the definition of their existence had to evolve.
From a fortress to a club.
Exactly. They transitioned from a literal fortress that you were born into, one that dictated your entire life, to a borderless global club bound by sympathy and shared heritage. The physical geography is gone, but that invisible baggage, you know, the values, the history, the familial ties, that remains intact.
And today, the internet is the infrastructure holding them together.
Right. It's replacing the village squares of the past.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting. Because now that they are an open club living on the internet, they are facing a completely new, incredibly modern threat. It's not an invading army. It's not a dictator. It is generative AI.
The rise of large language models, systems like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, poses an existential threat to their history. And to understand why an algorithm is so dangerous to an 800-year-old culture, we have to look at the mechanics of these models.
The GPT.
Right. The technological foundation is the GPT generative pre-trained transformer.
When you ask a chatbot a question about medieval history, it is not like opening a verified file folder.
Yeah.
It is running highly advanced statistics, calculating the most likely next word based on billions of data points it scraped from the web. It's called next token prediction.
Yeah, and Dr. Lauer refers to these models as stochastic parrots.
Stochastic parrots. That is just the perfect terminology.
It really is. Think about a parrot mimicking a human voice. It has excellent syntax, but zero semantic understanding. A stochastic parrot knows exactly how to speak, and it sounds incredibly authoritative, but it doesn't actually comprehend what it is saying. It is just stringing together statistically probable vectors.
It is like watching a brilliant actor recite a deeply emotional 10-minute monologue in a language they do not speak a single word of. They hit all the right inflections, the accent is flawless, and the audience is weeping. But if you walk up to that actor afterward and ask, what did that speech actually mean?
Yeah.
They just look at you blankly.
Precisely. There is no comprehension behind the performance.
And we've all seen this, right?
Yeah.
You ask AI for a recipe or a movie plot, and it confidently lies to you. We laugh it off when it invents a fake ingredient, but when it applies that same confident lying to a fragile culture, it's not funny anymore.
Not at all. Because the history of the Transylvanian Saxons is incredibly niche, the AI lacks the massive volumes of training data it has for, say, American history. And when a model lacks data, it attempts to fill the gaps using statistical guesses.
And that results in hallucinations.
Exactly. It creates synthetic, fake knowledge that sounds perfectly authentic. If an AI hallucinates the complex reasons for their exodus or fundamentally misunderstands the nuance of defensive tolerance, it isn't just making a typo. It is actively rewriting their identity in the digital space for anyone who queries it.
Which brings us to the core philosophical difference between the machine and the human. Dr. Lauer draws heavily on sociologists and philosophers like Max Weber and Clifford Geertz to explain this, focusing on the concepts of thin versus thick description.
Yes. AI is only capable of providing thin description. It can process the raw data, the syntax, the dates, the geographic coordinates.
Surface stuff?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But humans, the historians, the sociologists, the descendants of the culture, we provide thick description. We understand the intention behind an action. We understand the cultural codes, the shared trauma, the humor, the soul of the event.
Generative AI is, at best, a highly efficient digital librarian rapidly retrieving text.
That's all it is. Evaluation, contextual meaning, and truth. Those remain exclusively human domains.
So what does this all mean for the Transylvanian Saxons? If generative AI is this incredibly fast, dangerously convincing stochastic parrot, how do they tame it? How do they ensure that their deeply human thick description isn't completely overwritten by the machine's statistically probable thin description?
Well, the solution is to engineer a verified ground truth for the AI to train on. That is the entire purpose of the Transylvanian Saxons A Portrait Project. They are not just writing a book, they are building a massive, rigorously vetted digital knowledge base.
And crucially, it is trilingual, published simultaneously in German, English, and Romanian.
Which is brilliant.
It really is. German is their historical language, but the modern descendants living in the USA and Canada speak English, and the younger generation studying back in Romania today speak Romanian. By making the ground truths trilingual, they ensure the AI learns the complex cultural nuances across the actual languages that modern people are using to ask questions about them.
And technologically, they're implementing two incredibly powerful systems to force the AI to behave and respect that ground truth, RAG and knowledge graphs.
Okay, let's break those down.
So RAG stands for Retrieval Augmented Generation. Instead of letting the AI guess the next word based on its vast, noisy training data from the broader internet, our RAG intervenes. It forces the AI to retrieve information exclusively from their specific verified database before it is allowed to generate a single word of its answer.
Let's visualize how different this is.
Yeah.
Imagine you are taking a tour through a historical museum. A standard AI is like a hyper-creative, fast-talking tour guide who just loves making up dramatic myths to keep the tourists entertained.
Right, the stochastic parrot.
Exactly. But our Anna Knowledge Graph introduces a strict, unsmiling museum curator who follows right behind that tour guide. A knowledge graph doesn't just store text. It maps out rigid semantic relationships. It locks data together.
That locking mechanism is the key to all of this. In a normal LLM, the relationship between a city like Hermannstadt and its founding date is just a statistical probability. But in a knowledge graph, node A, the city of Hermannstadt, is mathematically locked to node B, first mentioned in 1191.
So the creative tour guide cannot invent a new founding date.
Exactly, because the strict curator, the knowledge graph, aggressively fact-checks the statement against a master ledger before the guide is even allowed to open their mouth.
It completely strips away the AI's ability to hallucinate. It can use its eloquence to summarize the facts beautifully, but it cannot alter the facts.
And all of this technological architecture is governed by one overarching principle, HITL, or human in the loop.
The human stays in charge.
Always. The human researcher remains the author, the truth checker, and the moral compass. The AI is relegated to its proper place. It's just a tool used to translate, format, and distribute that human-verified truth to a global audience.
I want to highlight one specific initiative in Lauer's project that completely blew me away. They aren't just locking down text and dates. They are looking at using specialized open source AI models, specifically referencing a Swiss system called Apertus, to digitally preserve the actual sounds of their endangered dialects.
This part is so cool.
They highlight the Reussian dialect, which has this incredibly distinct, melodious tone. Because Apertus is open source, they can train it locally on their own audio archives without surrendering their cultural data to a massive tech corporation.
That privacy aspect is huge.
It is. They can literally teach the AI to speak in the exact cadence of their ancestors, keeping the sounding homeland alive.
This represents a monumental shift in how we think about heritage. The community is moving from merely preserving their past, like keeping artifacts trapped under glass, to actively shaping their digital future.
By building this rigid ground truth.
Yes. They are ensuring that future generations won't just inherit raw, easily distorted data points. They will inherit a scientifically grounded compass for their identity. They aren't hoping the machine remembers them correctly. They're forcing the machine to remember them correctly.
They're taking control of their own narrative on a civilizational scale. And that brings us back to you, listening right now. I want you to think about your own digital footprint. Think about the thousands of photos, texts, emails, and social media posts you generate.
It's a lot of data.
It is. And the Transylvanian Saxons recognize that if they didn't actively build a ground truth for their 900-year history, the AI age would simply pave over it with a statistically probable but entirely fake version of who they were.
It forces us to ask a deeply personal question. What happens to our own invisible baggage when we are no longer here to explain the context behind our data?
Think about your own family history, your own memories, your own inside jokes. When future AI models scrape the internet 50 years from now to tell your descendants who you were, what ground truth are you leaving behind for the machine to find? Will it just be a thin description of your social media likes and out-of-context comments? Or are you actively preserving the thick description of your soul? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take a moment today to think about the walls you're building, the culture you're protecting, and the truth you are leaving behind.